The reading today is Genesis chapter 16, verses 1 to the end, and it can be found on page 9 of your pew Bible. Now Sarah, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian servant named Hagar. So she said to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go sleep with my servant. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Abram agreed to what Sarah said. So after Abram had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarah, his wife, took her Egyptian servant Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar, and she conceived. When she knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. Then Sarah said to Abram, "You are responsible for the wrong I am suffering. I put my servant in your arms, and now that she knows she is pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." "Your servant is in your hands," Abram said. "Do with her whatever you think best." Then Sarah mistreated Hagar, so she fled from her. The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was the spring that is beside the road to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, servant of Sarah, where have you come from and where are you going?" "I'm running away from my mistress Sarah," she answered. Then the angel of the Lord told her, "Go back to your mistress and submit to her." The angel added, "I will increase your descendants so much that they will be too numerous to count." The angel of the Lord also said to her, "You are now pregnant, and you will give birth to a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard of your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hands will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility toward all his brothers." She gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her, "You are the God who sees me." For she said, "I have now seen the one who sees me." That is why the well was called Be'er Lahai Roi. It is still there between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram gave the name Ishmael to the son who she had born. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael. This is the word of the Lord.
Hello. Good morning. Traditionally, the scripture passage for Epiphany is Matthew 2. When the Magi from the East visit the baby Jesus, the preacher is always obligated to point out on Epiphany that there were not necessarily three wise men, and they were not kings, but something like astrologers, which is why they were paying attention to the stars. And the Magi are important in the church calendar because they represent Gentiles, that is, non-Jews, and their visit to Jesus initiates the revelation of the gospel to the Gentiles. And they call it the Epiphany. The Magi bring three gifts, but there could have been two Magi, there could have been four Magi, and I suppose they could have brought other gifts as well. But the gold and the frankincense and the myrrh represent things that will become important in the life of Jesus. The song, "We Three Kings," again, not three, not kings, go over these gifts and their importance. The perhaps three Magi and the feast day of Epiphany become important enough in the history of the church that the Magi eventually gain names and identifying features. And I have a couple of paintings. Emily? Click. There we go. This is El Greco and Adoration of the Magi. And then the next one, Hieronymus Bosch. You can see that there are always three. And then the next one, Albrecht Dürer. And if you look closely, there are defining features of the three different Magi. So they gain names over time. They become Melchior, Caspar, and Balthazar. And they come from different regions, one from the north and one from the east and one from the south. It appears that the south would be Africa, which explains their different skin tones. Again, this is all inventions of many years later. Matthew doesn't give them names, doesn't say which countries they're from, and doesn't say how many there are. But the tradition of Epiphany as the revelation of the Son of God to the Gentiles provides the impetus to create a backstory for these otherwise mysterious characters. All right, all of this is to say I'm not preaching on the Magi from the East. Rather, I picked a different passage from Scripture. You can click to the next one. There you go. Okay, yeah. But interestingly enough, it shares several themes that populate the traditional passage of the first Epiphany. So firstly, features a Gentile. Hagar, we are told a few times, is Egyptian and not from Abram's family or Canaan. Secondly, there is a divine revelation to this Gentile, and that includes a promise, which, thirdly, is that Hagar will bear a child who will be a king of sorts, or rather give birth to a nation, and his name will be Ishmael. Fourthly, someone is given a name. This time, the naming is not by artists or storytellers centuries after the composition of the text, but actually in the story itself. In fact, there are two names given. The angel of the Lord gives the name Ishmael to Hagar's baby son, and Hagar, in a very striking scene, gives a new name to God. Fifthly, there are very dark events casting shadows over both of these stories. Two in particular that unfortunately follow us through history and continue to challenge us. The revelation of God and the promises that follow apparently do not stem the tide of slavery or genocide in ways that satisfy our desires. Now, what I'm not saying by pointing these similarities out is that these stories are related in any formal way. I don't think that Matthew had the story of Hagar in one hand as he was recounting the arrival of the Magi to Bethlehem. Instead, I think that perhaps both stories are somewhat typical to God's concern for the outsider. So let's look a bit closer at the story of Hagar in Genesis 16. As you may know, there are two stories of Hagar encountering God in the wilderness after being expelled from the household of Abraham and Sarah. This is the first one, and it comes pretty early in the overarching story of Abram and his covenant with God. In chapter 15, Abram has his own encounter with God, where he complains that he doesn't have an heir to inherit his estate. God tells him that an heir will come from his own body and that his descendants will be so many that he won't be able to count them. God doesn't say who the mother of these descendants will be, though. And as we learn soon enough, this leads him and his wife to make plans that will fix that. Abram and Sarah were quite old at this point, and Sarah had not yet had any children, so she suggests that Abram have a child with her maidservant, Hagar. Phyllis Trible, who's a biblical scholar, in her classic close reading of challenging passages, it's called Texts of Terror, notes how objectified Hagar is in the story. Neither Sarah nor Abram ever mention her by name. They just call her maidservant or slave. For Sarah, Hagar is an instrument, not a person, writes Trible. The maid enhances the mistress. Nevertheless, to Abram, Hagar becomes a wife. This is not unheard of at the time. Men had multiple wives for the purposes of building up the family. It will happen with Abram's grandson Jacob as well, and as with Jacob, having multiple wives creates conflict in the household. Hagar, the powerless slave, becomes pregnant with the heir of Abram's fortune, and the power dynamic shifts in the home. Sarah begins with Hagar as an object to be used to build herself up. She gives her maidservant to Abram for her own building up, but that doesn't work so well as her maidservant becomes her rival wife. Not only that, but when Hagar becomes pregnant, Sarah is relegated in status. The NIV says Hagar despised her mistress, but the sense is perhaps one of belittlement. The status has all but reversed. The belittling of Sarah comes with the embiggening of Hagar. That's not a real word, but it's you may recognize. Oh, yeah, you recognize. Okay. And that doesn't sit well with the enslaver. Sarah needs Hagar to know her place. Sarah had intended to build herself up through her maidservant, but now she sees that she has experienced the opposite. Her response, therefore, is to oppress Hagar. The narrator expresses this quite cleverly. Sarah is small in Hagar's eyes, and so Sarah does what is good in her own eyes, which is a way of saying that it wasn't good in God's eyes. Now, Hagar was already the maidservant of Sarah, and perhaps we can assume that Sarah had some sort of fondness for Hagar at first, or she wouldn't have conceived of the plan to give her to Abram as a wife. But she still had all the power when she feels that power slipping. And when she feels that power slipping, she chooses to act harshly. In some translations, she oppresses Hagar. We're not told how she oppresses Hagar, but it leads to Hagar fleeing to the wilderness immediately. It appears she was on her way back to Egypt, her home, but she stops to get some water to drink at a spring. And remarkable things happen at springs in the Bible. Several heroes meet their future wives as well, at wells of springs. Rebecca, Rachel, Miriam are all found at wells by their suitors. But Hagar's discovery by a well is a much different circumstance. She's trying to flee her suitor. And here, at this well, it is the messenger of the Lord who finds her and asks her where she is going and from where she is fleeing. Hagar tells the messenger that she is fleeing Sarah, but doesn't say why. However, the Lord seems to know why. Here is where things get disturbing. For even though Hagar has been treated poorly and is a subjugated person, things are not out of the ordinary. This is not to excuse Sarah or Abram's behavior. It's just a recognition that some behavior is typical throughout history, so it's disturbing in a very human way. It's only at the spring where disturbing goes supernatural. Go back to your mistress and submit to her, is what the angel says. This is a reasonable translation, but softens the meaning, for the word submit is the same word as oppressed or mistreated in verse 6. That is, the angel is telling Hagar to go back and experience the same treatment that drove her away. What kind of an epiphany is this? I thought that God was supposed to liberate the slaves. Here's what Mary says in the Gospel of Luke. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy according to the promise he made to our ancestors, to Abraham and to his descendants forever. Mary even mentions Abraham in her song. But even if we were to excuse Mary and say that her song is aspirational, bringing down the powerful is something that is ideal, but doesn't happen all that often, that is. Ordering someone to be oppressed doesn't comply at all with this song. The angel of the Lord does have more to say, and Hagar seems to hear the following as a way to temper the problems of the first statement. The angel added, this is the text, "I will increase your descendants so much that they will be too numerous to count." The angel of the Lord also said to her, "You are now pregnant, and you will give birth to a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard of your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him, and he will live in hostility toward all his brothers." This sounds like a hybrid of God's promise to Abram in the previous chapter and the Annunciation of Mary in Luke, which leads to Mary's song above. The first promise is that Hagar will not only give birth to a son, but that she will have many, many descendants. If you are reading the book of Genesis straight through, you might think that promise sounds familiar. For in the previous chapter, God makes a similar promise to Abram. Quote, "Look toward heaven and count the stars if you are able to count them. So shall your descendants be." And of course, the Annunciation of Hagar. "You are now pregnant and will give birth to a son, and you shall name him Ishmael." Very reminiscent of Isaiah 7:14. "Look, the young woman is pregnant and will give birth to a son and shall name him Emmanuel." So just Emmanuel and Ishmael are really different. And also the Annunciation of Mary. "And now you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you will name him Jesus, and he will be great, and he will be called Son of the Most High, and the Lord God will give him the throne of his ancestor David." So Phyllis Trible is sure to point out that Hagar, despite the promises, is excluded from the covenant here. Ishmael is not the son who will inherit the promised land. God will see to it that Sarah will be able to have children despite her age, and her son Isaac will receive the full inheritance. But this story shows us that Gentiles and outsiders do receive the attention and care of God. Ishmael's name means God hears, and that acts as another promise of sorts. Go back and be oppressed, bad. But know that I have heard your oppression and will continue to be with you. Most remarkably is that this particular Gentile woman not only receives gifts, but gives them too. While the tradition of Epiphany stems from a revelation to educated men who are wealthy enough to be able to give gifts of gold, and who over the centuries have been elevated in status to kings, the very first Epiphany to a Gentile was to a female African slave woman fleeing from her owners. Not only that, but giving gifts is one thing. Giving a name is a much bigger deal. Giving names is what God does. God gives the name of Hagar's son, for instance. God will change the name of Abram to Abraham and Jacob to Israel. But Hagar gives a new name to God, El Roi. In this way, it is like the gift of the Magi, but not from the Bible. O. Henry's story, The Gift of the Magi, perhaps you read that. At O. Henry's, The Gift of the Magi, a poor married couple give each other gifts, but have to sell their own belongings in order to do so. The man sells his pocket watch to get his wife a set of ornamental combs for her hair, but the woman sells her hair to buy her husband a chain for his pocket watch. So, I ruined the story for you. I apologize, but it's not very long. So, in this story, God hears of the affliction of Hagar and gives her son the name Ishmael, which means God hears. Hagar then gives God a new name. They are exchanging gifts as opposed to just one person giving gifts to the other. She gives her God a new name, El Roi, the God who sees me. This is a truly amazing scene, for it's the only place in the Bible, as far as I am aware, where someone gives a new name to God. There are similar instances, but nothing like this, and it is done by one of truly low status. But there's still that upsetting part. Why this story made it into texts of terror? Yes, there is a promise, but it doesn't eliminate the oppression right away. Hagar is told to go back and suffer, and that is difficult to justify. This is the same God that Mary says he has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. The psalmist says God executes justice for the oppressed, gives food to the hungry, and sets the prisoners free. And many places it says, I brought you up from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery. So this seems against the normal practice of God to send someone back to an unjust situation. But there's more to this story. I have found that the stories in the book of Genesis all point to other stories in the book, and usually just before or after. And this one is no different. The reversal between Hagar and Sarah is just one reversal in the story. In chapter 15, when Abram receives the covenant with God and the promise seems so similar to Hagar's, look toward the heavens and count the stars if you are able to count them, so shall your descendants be. He has that promise tempered by a warning in verse 13, if you're looking, Charlie. Charlie has his Bible open. Then the Lord said to Abram, know this for certain, that your offspring shall be aliens in a land that is not theirs, and shall be slaves there, and they shall be oppressed for 400 years. And we readers know that the land in which they will be slaves is Egypt, which is, of course, the same place that Hagar, the slave, is from. And I suppose you could read this connection a few different ways. One might see some kind of social justice, a kind of a perverted social justice, not in the way that it's normally spoken of, but where every action is justified somehow. And here is an Egyptian enslaved and oppressed by Abraham. But in the future, Abram's descendants will be enslaved and oppressed by Egypt. But I think you'll find the economy, that economy of justice will not play out in the rest of the Bible and is not the overarching message of the gospel. Rather, I think that the effect of these two stories back to back is to help us recognize that the plight of the covenant people and the plight of the Gentile can be very similar in experience, and that God's blessings are available to both. We all experience hardships. We all experience tragedy. Some of us are lucky and get through life with only a few issues here and there. Others of us have a very difficult go of it. But there's also an explanation deeper in the passage here, for Hagar didn't just stop by a random spring. The text says she was at a spring on the way to Shur. Shur doesn't show up much in the Bible, but it does show up in a key moment that highlights the connection again with the promise to Abraham. In Exodus 15, just after the Israelites escaped their bondage from Egypt, we read, "Moses ordered Israel to set out from the Reed Sea, and they went to the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water." 3 days without water is what Hagar might have expected had she kept on. That is a long time for a poor pregnant woman to be without water. She almost certainly would have died. In fact, it was a big problem for the Israelites who found themselves in the wilderness of Shur 400 years later. The appearance by the messenger of the Lord, then, is an intervention to save Hagar. Her desperation and recognition of her salvation is evident in her response. She doesn't resist, which would have been understandable. But in a society like the ancient world, a thirsty, starving, pregnant slave woman on the run would have had few options for survival. Another thing about this being oppressed compared to her previous being oppressed is that Hagar is returning to Abram and Sarah with the knowledge that God has heard her oppression and has seen her in her times of trial. As Terence Fretheim puts it, Hagar will no longer be dependent upon God's promises to Abraham and Sarah as she stands on her own in relationship with God. While readers might wish for a freer future for Hagar herself at this point, she moves with what is possible in the situation. She trusts in the word of God that the future will contain a new form of freedom. And indeed, freedom is what she will get. For her son, named Ishmael, meaning God hears, will be a wild donkey of a man. It's not an insult. Instead, it's a recognition that Ishmael will be dependent on no one but God. Hagar's oppression is temporary, but her lineage will be free. Her suffering has been given meaning, and that can still be difficult to take, no doubt. But suffering is something that is part of life, as we all know. The story of Hagar and the entire Bible really recognizes the reality of suffering for the many. The story speaks to us where we are. There's more to say about Hagar, but I want to fast forward many centuries in the biblical story. Past the birth of Ishmael and the 400 years of bondage in Egypt, past the ups and downs of the monarchy and exile to Babylon and return, and even past the epiphany in Matthew. Jesus is now grown, and he is preaching and healing and showing the people of Judea that he and God are one and the same. He is like the messenger of the Lord who, after appearing to Hagar, Hagar names El-Roi, the God who sees. And we see that Jesus, like the God of Hagar, sees all varieties of people in their own suffering. He sees the blind man with the withered hand, the woman who can't stop bleeding, the man with the sick daughter. He sees the abused, the barren, and the shamed, the Jew, the Samaritan, and the Gentile. And the gospel writers say that he has compassion. And many, but not all, of these people he healed, or he fed, or he amazed. But we know that is not all he did. He also suffered himself. He suffered alongside us and suffered on the cross, so that we have a partner in our suffering. But not just any partner, a partner who suffered greatly and suffered bearing a promise. Myrrh, by the way, one of the gifts that he received was an embalming. The promise was the resurrection, which proved that all suffering is to be temporary. The resurrection ratified Mary's song that the lowly will be lifted and the hungry will be filled. But Hagar's promise and eventual liberation was a foretaste, even of the gospel of Jesus. The God who saves has been saving from the beginning, after all.